how we can bring the Dharma or the teaching as embodied in concepts like the Four Noble Truths into a more direct application in our lives. And this is an interest, an emphasis that has been with me for a long time. And, during the years that I was working with mental health in mental health institutions, doing mindfulness-based stress reduction when I was staying with John Kabat-Zinn, as well as when I was working in a more traditional, Buddhist sort of context, and teaching, Dharma in a more traditional way. And it sort of came to a head in my own experience because of some controversy that has arisen in sort of Buddhist and Dharma circles about what is legitimately Buddhist and what is not legitimately Buddhist in terms of the various forms of meditation. Now, for those of you who are familiar with MBSR and who might be sort of familiar with the sort of discourse in Dharma circles, it comes down to a story that actually John Kabat-Zinn talks about in terms of the acceptance of mindfulness-based stress reduction or meditation as applied to health and wellness within the context of a larger Buddhist framework, because this is a mindfulness practice that comes from the original teachings of the Buddha. So, on the other hand, there are elements within the Buddhist hierarchy, primarily Mahayana Buddhist hierarchy, which I would say in terms of Tibetan Buddhism, who don't accept the health and wellness, the applications of mindfulness to health and wellness as a legitimate expression of, Buddhism or Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist teaching. So there's a bit of a tension, within the various elements of the Buddhist community about the validity of secular applications of mindfulness for health and wellness. And so John Kabat-Zinn tells this famous story. He was actually in Dharamsala, had been invited to give a presentation to the Dalai Lama on mindfulness-based stress reduction. And there was an audience of scholars and academicians, I would say mostly American or Western scholars. So there was this audience, and he gave this presentation on, mindfulness-based stress reduction. And then some of the other academicians gave their presentation, which was basically, this is, not orthodox Buddhist teaching. So as the story goes, and this is a story that was told by John Kabat-Zinn, the Dalai Lama sort of leans back and he says, well, okay, tell me, how many people are there in the world? And so they said, roughly about 7 billion people. And so he said, well, how many people are Buddhist? And they scratched their head and they said, well, maybe about 1 billion, maybe 1.5 billion or so. So there's roughly 6.5 or 6 billion people who are not Buddhist. And he says, well, do you think this might help them? And I said, yeah, it might. He said, well, I think it's good then. So it's okay, So, so that's the story that John says, right? So it's like this was his acceptance of mindfulness-based stress reduction as a legitimate form of practice. But it's interesting, years later, and, of course, as far as I was concerned, I was good with that, but then years later, I actually got into some discussion with some other academicians on the same subject. And so, and I told the story that John Kabat-Zinn told me, and then they said to me, oh yeah, we know that story, except we know it from another perspective. So, he said, yeah, well, as the story goes, John Kabat-Zinn gave this presentation, And the Dalai Lama said, yeah, it was okay. But then the other folks kind of said, well, yeah, it's okay, but it's not Buddhism. And so, you know, it's like, all right, so it's good. It's good for you to want to help people and be of service to, you know, humankind and all of that. But don't call it Buddhism. And so there was this, there's literally a cleavage, you know, there's a separation between those who would call this Buddhism and those who wouldn't. And this has come out publicly in various forums. To me, I think that's quite unfortunate, you know, that there would be this conflict of views, you know, within the Dharma community about what is legitimate and what is not legitimate. And so in my own experience, my own view of things, it sort of has caused me to kind of step back and think about this, you know, within the larger context of, well, what is Buddhism? Who was the Buddha? What was the original intent of his teachings? You know, how does all this, you know, come together? And so, in my own work, it's sort of my own sort of leaning is toward more of a lay application, you know, of the teachings. And as I said before, I've worked with people in mental health situations and stress reduction and emotional regulation and management. So I began to try to sort of redefine my own understanding of the Dharma. And within the context of what is enlightenment? What is it? Why do we do this practice? Why do we strive for awakening? What is awakening? What is enlightenment? And, you know, this leads to some very, very interesting questions in terms of what people actually regard as enlightenment. And, of course, there's, depending on what tradition you look at, for example, in the Theravadan tradition in Southeast Asia and Burma, it's an extremely complex structure of attainments that one goes through in one's training process to attain what are defined as the four levels of enlightenment, you know, stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, arahant, and Buddha. So, and this is literally the curriculum by which one defines one's progress in the process of spiritual awakening. So, there, you know, there's a whole structure of, and this is only Theravadan. This says nothing about, you know, Zen or Tibetan Buddhism or, you know, other later historical forms of Buddhism in terms of how they interpret, you know, the enlightenment process. So it can get very complicated and very argumentative sometimes in terms of what is actually defined as enlightenment. So for my intents and purposes, I try to kind of begin to think about this more in terms of how we can begin to bring it down to a more pragmatic, more intimate level in terms of our personal experience, while not being in violation of, you know, the basic, what are regarded as the basic tenets of Buddhism or the Four Noble Truths. And so, what is real within ourselves in terms of the physicality of our bodies, our sensations, our sensory experience in the world, the feelings that arise in response to our sensory experience, and how these feelings can either lead to awakening or they can lead to suffering. They can lead to happiness or they can lead to conflict, anger, aversion, and destructive, you know, sort of directions in our lives. And the decisions that we make about our sensory experience in the world are really the bedrock that set in motion the karmic implications that determine whether our lives move in the direction of happiness, wisdom, peace, serenity and equanimity, or they move in the direction of, you know, anger, retribution, vindication, revenge, violence, you know, and destruction. So, in essence, the definition of enlightenment, for me, has really come down to our capacity to navigate the vicissitudes of life that we experience in our everyday lives, the difficulties, the realities of suffering, the realities of illness, of, you know, mental, physical suffering, ultimately the reality of our eventual decline and death, you know. Ultimately, it comes down to, you know, sort of the confrontation with impermanence within ourselves, and yet be able to move through these situations with a sense of understanding, of wisdom, equanimity, and peace. So it's really more about our ability to navigate the realities of our everyday life that, to me, determine what it means to be awakened, rather than, for example, some, you know, permanent transcendent state of bliss or rapture, you know, which we often hear about, you know, through the meditative state, or some transcendent kind of wisdom and knowledge that somehow answers all the questions so one becomes omniscient, omnipotent, sort of all-knowing. It's not about that sort of thing. I think it's all about using the practice, using the awareness and the knowledge that comes from the practice, to be able to live a better life in our lives on a day-to-day basis, so that we can move through all the difficulties and all the challenges that we face with an openness, with an honesty, with a courage that allows us to deeply understand, you know, the dynamics of our experience, so that we emerge with a sense of wisdom, a sense of understanding, compassion, forgiveness, acceptance, and ultimately peace. So the question is, so it's a really more of an intimate and everyday, common sense, practical, pragmatic approach to what enlightenment or awakening actually is. And if you look at it, for example, if you look at the Four Noble Truths, the whole structure of the Four Noble Truths has to do with the reality of suffering in our lives, the fact that we do suffer, we have, you know, physical suffering, emotional suffering, you know, all of the circumstances that all of the emotional impact that the circumstances of our lives, you know, sort of evoke in our lives. And there are causes for suffering, which is the second noble truth. And the causes for suffering, of course, have to do with, you know, attachment, craving, wanting, aversion, you know, sort of the three horsemen of the apocalypse are, you know, craving, aversion, and ignorance, you know, sort of wanting things, or, you know, not wanting things, rejecting things, and not being aware that we're caught up in this cycle of, you know, running after things we can't get and running away from things we don't want. So this is basically, in very simple terms, the cause of suffering. And the third noble truth is, you know, the possibility, the reality of the possibility of liberation from suffering. We can liberate ourselves from this vicious cycle, you know, of craving and aversion. And of course, the fourth noble truth is the pathway to do that through the Eightfold Noble Path. So all of this is within the context of understanding what suffering is, and being able to come to terms with suffering in our lives in very real pragmatic ways that allow us to move through our life with a sense of wisdom, you know, understanding, peace, equanimity, and loving kindness, compassion, acceptance, and forgiveness. You know, so it's the classic opening of the mind and the opening of the heart. You know, it's called the wisdom path. So with a mind that's open and a heart that's pure and open, you know, we move through life with serenity and peace. without craving, without aversion. And you know, even within the larger cosmological context of birth and rebirth, you know, this will allow us to attain liberation from rebirth. You know, within the context of that term, those terms itself. So it has nothing to do with any kind of transcendent, you know, sort of state of being or any kind of, you know, sort of transcendent wisdom or knowledge that, you know, that transcends all, you know, mortal capabilities. It has to do with how we face the realities of our day-to-day, moment-to-moment life. And to me, that's the most powerful, most intimate, because it's the most difficult. It's the most difficult thing to do, to face the difficulties of our everyday life, our relationships, our jobs, our children, our, you know, our occupation, you know, our aspirations, our expectations, all the things that we carry within ourselves, our conditioning, our hopes, our fears, you know, our aversions. All of this, you know, what is the reality of this conflagration of stuff that, you know, that comprises this entity, which is myself? You know, what is this? How can I come to a better understanding of this so that I can live my life with equanimity and peace? So it's all about looking at our lives, looking at the intimacy of our life situation, and coming to a way of negotiating our passage through life so that we can work with our suffering, work with our craving, work with our aversions and our delusions and our prejudices and our petty likes and dislikes in ways that can free us of, you know, suffering, to bring a sense of understanding, wisdom, and peace, you know, in our lives. So it's really talking about looking at, say, the Four Noble Truths, or looking at suffering or afflictive emotions, negative emotions, not as things to be avoided or as things to be freed of, but really as a kind of gateway, as a pathway to deeper understanding and deeper wisdom about ourselves. And this is the one sort of interpretation of the Four Noble Truths which I feel the Buddha himself really emphasized, but often is not emphasized in the popular, you know, discussion of the Four Noble Truths, because we often think of suffering as something to be avoided, something to be freed of, something to, you know, sort of not have to deal with, right, in our lives. And at a very deep, almost subconscious level, we have this aversion toward things we don't like, things that don't feel good, things that make us uncomfortable, things that are strange, that are different, that don't taste good, that don't feel good. You know, we tend to just basically back away. You know, negative emotions, anger, hostility, rage, jealousy, envy, you know, annoyance, irritation, things that annoy us, things that make us angry or irritated. You know, we kind of back away, we soft pedal, we cover up, or we avoid. But it's only by facing these emotions, facing these negative afflictive emotions, that they begin to reveal to us the ways in which we get hooked, the ways in which we are conditioned, the ways in which we bring expectations to the table that are not fulfilled and therefore cause us to be angry and rejected and et cetera, et cetera. You see, so it's by really looking into our afflictive emotions, looking into ourselves, you know, that the pathway to awakening, to enlightenment goes. It goes through these negative emotions. So it's almost incumbent upon us to look at our suffering almost as a gift to ourselves in terms of, you know, more effectively and better understanding how we get triggered, why we get triggered, and what we bring to the table that causes us to suffer, you know, as a result of our afflictive emotions. So the basic idea of awakening, you know, really comes down to this notion of opening to our afflictive emotions, understanding, not being afraid of our afflictive emotions, opening to them, accepting them, and seeing them as gateways, as pathways to greater understanding and wisdom about ourselves. And of course, the practice, in doing so, the practice begins to resolve these afflictive emotions. It reduces their toxic effect that it has on our lives. So in a way, as we work with these emotions, we are building the basis for health and wellness, you know, in the sense of not being, you know, sort of overwhelmed and controlled by our negative emotions, you know, read stress management, emotional regulation. And at a deeper level, you know, resolving our relationship to these emotions so that they don't affect us negatively anymore in the future. So that's, you know, the analogy is, you know, if you see a patch of weeds, you know, on the ground, if you want to get rid of the weeds, you can do two things. You can take a lawnmower and you can, you know, cut all the weeds off, or you can go in and pull each weed out by the roots. So health and wellness might be, you know, like cutting off the tops with a good lawnmower, whereas freedom from suffering is going in and pulling them out by the roots, so that, you know, the whole plant comes out, the whole weed comes out, the whole afflictive emotion comes out. So there's a range of responses that we can use to work with our emotions, one at the level of health and wellness, you know, read stress management, emotional regulation, all the way to complete freedom from suffering, which is the ultimate kind of awakening, the freedom from suffering itself. And that they're basically on a continuum. It's not one versus the other. It's not this is Buddhist and this is not Buddhist. But it's all part of this continuum. And basically, it's an issue of mental health. And this gets back to, you know, what you might interpret to be, to have been the charge of the Buddha when he was alive. And oftentimes I look back on, you know, if you read about the Buddha, his life and his teachings, in today's modern world, he would probably be regarded as a psychotherapist, in the sense that, you know, he would sit down and really teach about emotional suffering, you know, why we suffer. And in those days, they didn't have those terms. So he was basically, actually, in many of his stories, he uses the analogy of a doctor, you know, of a person, a healer who comes to heal us of our suffering. So in a certain way, there's a sort of kind of a medical analogy or psychotherapeutic analogy. But it's not about a religion. It's not about a belief system. It's not about believe this and something will happen. It's about verifying through our own personal experience the validity of the teachings as revealed through our own practice, through our own ability to face our own selves. And through the facing of our own selves, come to resolution of the suffering that affects us in our lives. So it's a whole different approach. It's not a religion. It's not a belief system. It's not a dogma. It's really a set of instructions, you know, like the Eightfold Noble Path, right? Ways in which we can use the skills, the techniques of the practice to apply to ourselves so that we can live healthier, more, you know, sort of stress-free lives, and ultimately down the road, you know, really work with the deeper suffering that we experience in our lives. So I see it really as a continuum, and that continuum really has a basic, intimate relevancy to the everyday life that we all live on a moment-to-moment basis. And it's not about anything that's transcendent in any way, or any sort of permanent state of mind, or, you know, state of bliss, or state of, you know, sort of all transcending wisdom that somehow, you know, solves all the problems because you know all the answers. No, it's about working on a moment-to-moment basis with our own personal experience as it arises in our own lives. So the way this, you know, through my own experience, I've basically sort of, in a way, this is kind of a functional sort of breakdown. If you look at an afflictive emotion as it arises, basically it's comprised of three parts. I mean, you know, think about it. You know, anytime you get angry or sad or some emotion arises, there's the emotion itself, whatever that emotion is, whether it's sadness, grief, happiness, or anger, or rage, whatever it might be, jealousy, disappointment, stress, annoyance, you know, that emotion is there. And then there's the context, you know, that out of which that emotion arises, you know, a certain circumstance that, you know, out of which this particular emotion, you know, sort of results. And then there are actors. There are actors, you know, the people who might have triggered a certain response. I mean, at the very least, there's you, right? And most times there's another person or other people, you know, that trigger certain responses by their actions, right? So there's the emotion itself, there's the context, and then there are actors, you know, which determine the entire sort of gestalt around which a particular emotion would arise. Now, I would submit that there are this whole notion of working with emotions in terms of, you know, sort of emotional management or mindfulness-based stress reduction, and working with it sort of in a deeper, more fundamental level in terms of freedom from suffering, is influenced by how we look at these three components of an afflictive emotion, and how through the meditative process we work through these three components. So this is really key in terms of understanding how meditation sort of affects this whole process and why it's so fundamental to this process of, you know, personal emotional transformation. Now the first is obviously the emotion itself, you know, so, and this is why when we, you know, what is the actual energetic content of the emotion? When you get angry or when rage, you know, we've all experienced extreme emotional states when we get either extremely happy or extremely angry, or rage arises. We don't usually pay attention, but there are physical, you know, symptoms of that emotional state because it's an energetic state that arises in the body. So if anger is arising, you know, you can feel your hair standing up on end, on your skin is tingling, you know, your face gets very flushed, the blood is flushing to the surface of your skin, and the hair is standing up on your skin, and you know, you feel, you know, surges running up and down the spine, and you know, your back hunches up, your muscles contract, you know, it's this sort of fight or flight kind of, you know, response. So, you know, definitely, you know, we actually feel the energy of the emotion as it arises. Now, one of the first things that we learn in terms of mindfulness, in terms of emotional regulation, is that if we're in a state of meditation or just in terms of everyday life, say an extreme emotion arises, the first sort of step is to open to the energy of the emotion itself. Literally open to the feeling of the emotion. Now, those of you who are more advanced in the meditative practice know that, you know, in this moment of mindfulness, you know, where the mind is completely clear and still, and we just simply open to the energy of the emotion, you know, just the feeling of your face getting flushed, and, you know, the temperature rising, your hair standing on end, you know, all of the sense, the little energetic, you know, sort of eruption that's going on in the body. Just step back and just begin to observe it, you know, with this sense of, you know, objective, spacious awareness as it arises in the body. And not, see, the point is when we're in this state of mindfulness, we're not feeding that emotion. In other words, we're not adding, you know, pouring more fuel to the fire by, you know, by blaming something, by blaming a person, getting angry, or this so-and-so, this person did this, I'm going to, you know, that person is just an SOB, I'm going to do that to this person or that person, I'm going to I'm going to sue this person, I'm going to get my lawyer, I'm going to do this. You know, the mind just proliferates, right? As the mind proliferates, of course, the emotional stick is bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. But if we can cut through the proliferating mind, and I call it decontextualization, we decontextualize the emotion, and we just sit with the energy of the emotion itself, literally sit with the energy of the emotion itself. 9 out of 10 times, within 30 seconds, it'll just begin to dissipate and disappear. And this is actually how it works. It literally begins to attenuate and gradually fade away. This is something that, you know, a lot of people have noted, and in the clinical practice, this is how it's done. So when you're in a meditative state, you try not to interact with what you're feeling, but just open to the feeling itself. Now, what's happening is sort of occurring, I think, on different levels. On one level, which is easy to understand, you're not feeding it. You're not adding, you know, story. You know, you're not adding layers of story content to the emotion, which tends to exacerbate the emotion, make it stronger and stronger and stronger. So you're pulling away any kind of commentary or reactivity or judgment or anything, and you're just sitting with a clear, still mind, just feeling the emotion as it arises in the body. Now, if you're able to do that, you know, within not too long, it starts to attenuate and disappear. Now, the other explanation of this, you know, and this is a sort of a neurobiological explanation, and I think it's true, and that is that you cannot do two things at the same time. The mind does not multitask. I mean, I think that's been scientifically proven. We can go back and forth so quickly that it seems like we're multitasking, but the mind literally only does one thing at a time. Now, in the Buddhist teachings, what that means is, if you're in a moment of anger, right, so the consciousness is in anger, you know, you're caught up, you're inflamed in this moment of anger, and there's a moment of clear mindfulness. In that moment of clear mindfulness, you know, like, oh, anger, you know, so we note anger. In that simple noting of the anger, there's a immediate kind of objectivity that's established in terms of seeing the anger clearly as anger within the mind. In that moment of clarity, the anger is not there, because what's there is a moment of mindfulness, clear seeing. That's really important to understand. And it would be, it could happen in a hundredth of a second, so we don't even perceive it, but it's this quick nanosecond of clarity. Now, in the next nanosecond, you know, the anger might come back, right? Because it's this very powerful emotion that you're feeling in the mind. But if the mindfulness is strong, you know, the mindfulness comes back in the next nanosecond, anger comes back, mindfulness, anger, mindfulness. Then there's this, you know, back and forth playing of these mind moments of the afflictive emotion and the clear seeing of that emotion. But what's beginning to happen is you're starting to cut into the energy of the emotion itself through these moments of mindfulness. So gradually the energy of the anger begins to attenuate because it's no longer being fed and it's being sort of depleted of any sustaining energy because of these moments of mindfulness, as we observe the emotion as it arises. So this is the reason for the effect that people feel in these, you know, the cultivation of mindfulness as a stress reduction tool, because this is how it actually affects what we feel as far as, you know, negative emotions, anger, sadness, grief, however it arises. This is how it really works. So the first component is a very powerful component in terms of, you know, our being able to regulate, our being able to manage, you know, our afflictive emotions. So, I mean, just think of it. I mean, think of the value of this skill, of this ability that you cultivate through the practice. You know, so that you can be in a position where you can almost confidently say to yourself, whatever happens in my life, I can work with it. I can manage it. I don't have to be overwhelmed by my circumstances. That, I mean, I can't think of a more powerful affirmation that one can have for oneself than this sense of certainty that you can work with whatever arises in your life, no matter how difficult, how catastrophic, how tragic, you know, you can work with it. You don't have to be controlled by your circumstance. I mean, talk about confidence. That gives you this sustaining sense of inner strength that you don't have to be defeated in the world. You have the tools to work with your own suffering. I can't think of anything more powerful than that. So, in that sense, it's incredibly, incredibly powerful. So, this first step in mindfulness, in terms of the health and wellness aspect of it, is this ability to open to the energy of our emotions, you know, as they arise. Now, the second step has to do with the actors in the context. Now, one of the things, and I speak about this because this is something that has happened in my own experience, and people who have, you know, sort of developed depth in the practice have often reported similar sort of experiences. When you are in a state of mindfulness, and we speak of mindfulness in a state, as a state where the mind is completely still, the mind is quiet, you're in a state of absorbed concentration, where we're not just drifting back and forth in discursive thinking, commenting, you know, sort of reacting to our experience, but our mind is completely still, and we're completely open, and sort of accessible to our deeper inner emotions at the subconscious or even unconscious level, and say something arises within our, into our conscious awareness. Say a memory of some suffering as a child, or maybe sometimes this comes out as a sadness or grief at death of loved ones, or memories of abuse, or memories of negative experience that arose from a childhood experiences that we've repressed because we don't want to, you know, recognize or accept it. You know, say something like that starts to come up, or some hatred or jealousy or aversion that you don't want to, you know, sort of recognize begins to arise into your awareness. What happens is that you're starting to see this not with the mind in its normal sort of discursive, judgmental, reactive state, but a mind that's completely sort of in a way defenseless, a mind that's completely open. So as these emotions arise, you start to experience them in a way that you normally would never experience them, because you're not, when you're in your normal discursive state, you're generally judging, reacting, commenting, comparing, or, you know, stepping away, or spinning, you know, the story in some way that's more favorable to you, right? But if all of this is sort of removed, and you're in the state of open vulnerability, you start to see it. And the other side of this is that when the mind is quieted in that way, our capacity for sensory perception becomes enhanced, because the amount of energy that we would be burning thinking about things is actually beginning to be infused in the actual perception of things. So that's why when people often report when they're in a state of concentration, their sensory perception of the world becomes almost kind of surrealistic. I mean, like taste, smell, you know, sights, thoughts, everything becomes sort of amplified. There's a sense of amplification in your experience. And this happens when you get deeper into concentration. So if you're in that state and, say, an emotion arises, you feel it with an impact that is profound, almost to the point where it's a catharsis. And in that moment of clear seeing, you know, I often call it an epiphany. You have this epiphany of this, you know, emotional experience that's arising in your conscious mind, to the point where it's almost as if you could see the past, you could see the present, and you could see the future in one instant. In other words, you see where it came from, how it resulted in what you're experiencing, and what it's and what the implications are going forward. There's this moment of just clear seeing. And this has the quality of what we call an epiphany. It's like you see what this means. Now, I'll just use one prosaic example in my own life. I had this epiphany when I used to be a smoker, right? And, I just kept fighting, stopping smoking for many, many years until once in a moment of meditation, I had this epiphany of what the consequences of this habit pattern, was going to mean for me. And it just came to me with this clarity that I just simply couldn't deny. And so with that clarity just helped me to kind of just change my whole behavior pattern, with regard to smoking. And other people have said similar things about, relationships, sort of emotional, issues in their life. So there's this sense of clear seeing where all of a sudden you just see it with a clarity and a directness that is really sort of overwhelming and transforming. Now, what you start to see, too, is that what I call karmic alignment, in the sense that the way circumstances unfolded, the way they did, to cause you to have the emotion that you did in that moment, was absolutely perfect. And when I say absolutely perfect, I don't mean perfect in the sense of good, but I mean perfect in the sense that it could not have been any other way. In other words, the circumstances came together in the way they did, whether it was your parents or your mother, your father, your siblings, your family, or your work situation, or the people you were dealing with in a business arrangement in business, or your relationship. What they brought to the table in terms of their karmic, their karmic sort of their karmic heritage aligned with what you brought to the table with your karmic heritage came together in a way precisely to cause the emotional response that you experienced in that interaction. There was a reason why you got triggered the way you got triggered. And it's not about blame, it's not about it's their fault because they caused it. It's also about understanding that what you brought to the table and how that interaction caused the circumstances to unfold exactly in the way they did, which resulted in the emotion that you had. So if you start to see that, it's like, oh, okay, I get it. This is how it happened. So there's no blame here. There's no, there's no retribution or, vindication of anything. It's just this clear seeing of how all of these things came to pass. And when you start to see things in that way, there's this natural sense of acceptance because you know it couldn't have been any other way. This is the way it was. So your mind allows you to begin to accept what happened. Also, if there are other people involved, perhaps a sense of compassion, understanding, wisdom. Oh, okay, so you see how they did what they did, or you see what you did or what you brought to the table that caused yourself to be triggered in the way you were triggered. And out of that understanding comes this acceptance. It's like, okay, I get it. This is what happened. I understand. And that understanding becomes the basis for acceptance, forgiveness, and to a certain extent even compassion. If others were suffering to cause you to suffer, you can begin to see them with compassion and forgiveness in ways that perhaps you didn't originally because you were so angry at what they did to you. But you see that what they did to you was just the natural outcome of the circumstances affecting them and the circumstances affecting you. So you see this karmic perfection. I mean, this is the way things unfolded, and it couldn't have been any other way. So if you start seeing it that way, then the heart opens, with acceptance, wisdom, and compassion. And you're able to let it go. All of a sudden it doesn't have the toxic vitriolic effect on you that it probably had, you know, before that realization came to pass. So this is really what we, you know, what we call the wisdom path, you know, in the teachings. It's the path that opens through understanding, you know, karma, understanding how things came to be. And through that understanding, the heart opens with acceptance, forgiveness, compassion. And ultimately, the peace that allows you to let it go and not be controlled by those emotions. That's where the equanimity begins to arise. And that's where we find that moment of freedom, that moment of liberation from the toxic vitriolic effects of those negative emotions as they were affecting us when we were not aware of the karmic reality out of which that, the circumstances out of which that arose. So this is really how we attain that sense of liberation from suffering through going into, you know, the experience of the afflictive emotion itself and really resolving it at its energetic root in terms of the actual feeling of the emotion itself and also the whole karmic context out of which that emotion came and affected you the way it did. So that's the part where we start to pull it out by the roots. We literally pull it out by the roots and we transform our relationship to that emotion, our relationship to the context and to the actors in that context that caused that emotion to arise. We no longer relate to them in the same way. If we were angry, if there was anger or, you know, sort of hatred, all of a sudden that dissolves and it dissolves into understanding, compassion, and wisdom. So this is what freedom from suffering, liberation from suffering means. This is the dynamic through which it works its way out through this process of introspection, through this process of understanding and wisdom and compassion. So, to me, you know, this is what it really means, you know, to be awakened. You know, we're awakened from the causes of suffering and the impacts of suffering on our lives. And we also have the tools to work with suffering as it arises in our lives, through circumstances as they arise in our lives. So, I think that this, my interpretation, you know, if looking at the original work of the Buddha, and if you read the original sources in terms of the sutras and his teachings, basically I think this is really the sort of nexus of the key sort of, you know, sort of range of discourse that he was, you know, trying to express and trying to communicate in his teachings. And it's all very intimate, it's all very personal, and it has everything to do with how we, as individuals, live our lives. It doesn't have to do with some supernatural attainment, some state of, you know, sort of supernormal bliss or rapture or super, you know, superordinate kind of knowledge or wisdom or of how the universe works. It's not about, you know, cosmic consciousness or all that kind of stuff. It's about how we live our everyday, moment-to-moment lives. And this is where real freedom lies within us. And ultimately, it's about the freedom to face our own mortality, our own death, our own impermanence. Everything is impermanent. So all of the teachings with regard to impermanence, suffering, non-self, passion, aggression, ignorance, they all fit within this larger context of afflictive emotions, of working with suffering, suffering as it manifests in our lives, working with it as a gateway, as an avenue to liberation and not something to be avoided and run away from. But I think the bottom line, the most fundamental, important aspect of this entire practice is how do we bring that practice into our lives in a way that can make our lives a better life now. You know, not when we die, in terms of whether we're going to go to heaven or whatever, how our rebirth, but how we live a better life right now in the present moment. And so it has to do with emotional management, stress management, health and wellness, and all the way up to redefining our whole relationship to afflictive emotions in our lives. And it's all part of a continuum. And essentially, it has to do with consciousness. It has to do with awareness. Aware of all of these conditioning factors and drives and emotions that arise in our lives. And ultimately, it has to do with intelligence. Expanding those areas of awareness and consciousness so that we are conscious, aware, intelligent beings, but not driven by unconscious drives, conditioning, and patterns that then lead us, like in the, as Jon Kabat-Zinn says, into the automaticity of sleep and unconsciousness, but into the light of awakening, of consciousness, and awakening to true freedom for suffering. So it's about expanding our consciousness, expanding our awareness, expanding our intelligence, so that we can live truly better lives in this world. Okay, thank you so much. I really appreciate your attention.